You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when was the last time you took a dare around a scary legend? We'll talk to a field researcher who's made a career out of chasing and trying bizarre supernatural experiences for himself. Right now, it's time for our check-in on news stories from around the state. First, residents in Palmyra and Eagle in southeastern Wisconsin will see an advisory referendum on the fall ballot on whether or not to dissolve their school district. Bob Doerr is a reporter for the Now News Group, part of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering this story. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
You bet. My pleasure.
Well, this story goes back in part to last fall. There was an $11.5 million referendum on the ballot for the Palmyra Eagle district. Can you tell us what happened there and what it led the school board to do?
Yeah, it was actually, originally it was going to be in the fall, but then it was held April 2nd, so they had a $11.5 million operational referendum to help fund the school district and their finances. They're in some financial straits there, and it failed. It was soundly rejected, 61% to 39%, and prior to that vote, school board members and school district officials had been pretty clear that if this doesn't fail, we're going to have to start the process to dissolve.
What does that take? What is the district doing to try to dissolve itself now?
Well, they did a couple of different votes. About 6 days after that April 2nd vote, the school board, they call it considering to dissolve the district. That's the way the state statutes are spelled out. So they did that on April 8th. All but one school board member voted in favor of that resolution to consider dissolution. And then they followed that up with the July 1st vote, which was unanimous to order the dissolution. And that's where we stand now.
And there's a community petition now to have another vote. What is that about?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, the school board could have called for an advisory referendum on the matter for whatever reason they didn't. But the electorate, the members of the community do have the right by law to call for an advisory referendum if they get enough signatures on a petition. And they did that. There was an effort that took place. They needed, I think it was 403 signatures. The threshold was 10% of, you know, the voting public. And they got quite a bit more than that. They got around 700 signatures. So, I think there's 10 days they have if anyone wants to appeal those or that sort of thing. But I think with that number above the threshold, that we can pretty much be certain that there's going to be an advisory referendum on November 5th.
So the school board voted to dissolve. There will be this advisory referendum. But who ultimately decides if the school board or if the school will be dissolved?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one I didn't know before I started covering this story. There's a state entity called the School District Boundary Appeal Board, and that's kind of a statewide group of school board members from large, medium, and small districts that serve two-year terms, I think it is. And then from that 12-member board, there's a 7-member board that will decide this case.
We'll leave it there. Bob, thanks for bringing us up to date on this.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Bob Doerr is a reporter for Now News Group, part of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with us about an advisory referendum on the way on whether to dissolve the Palmyra Eagle School District. Now the U.S. Air Force is in the process of deciding where to station new F-35 fighter jets, and Madison's Truax Field is one of the places on the list. Last night, hundreds of residents attended a public meeting at the Alliant Energy Center to offer their take on the issue. Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, there was this big public meeting last night for people to weigh in on the prospect of these new F-35 jets being stationed at Truax Field in Madison. You were there. First, what concerns did some people bring up there?
There were largely two camps of people, supporters and opponents. The opponents or the people against it had a variety of concerns. Some of them just simply don't like the idea of bringing in new different warplanes, especially those that could be outfitted to carry nuclear weapons, even though the Air Force says that they would not be equipped, at least initially. Other people who, especially those who live on the east side, very concerned about noise. They're already you know, sometimes their houses shake when the F-16s fly over, and they're really concerned about these jets that could be up to four times louder, according to some of the Air Force's environmental study.
And what did the people who spoke in support of the project say?
A lot of them just were very pro-military. They said they just think it's important to support the armed forces. Others are very interested in the sort of economic impact that the base has on Madison, which is about $100 million a year. And, you know, their fear is that if for some reason they didn't get these F-35 jets, that, you know, that could spell the end of the 115th Fighter Wing's mission. The 115th now has F-16 jets that were built in 1987. They've been flying them since 92. They're some of the oldest F-16s in the Air Force fleet. So there is some concern that they can't keep using those forever.
Now, those F-16s are a familiar sight and sound in the Madison area. How, from what we know, how these F-35s compare as far as how often they'd be flying and how loud they would be?
They would be flying about 27% more often than the current operations. This is according to the environmental impact study. Although in the first year there would be quite a bit more because the F-16s would still be here. They would still be carrying out their mission, so you'd have some overlap. But then once the F-16s were gone, you know, it'd be about 6,200 operations a year. According to the Air Force's their environmental impact study on takeoff, the F-35s are about 20 decibels louder, and the way that sound works, that equates to it would feel about four times louder to the human ear.
And finally, Chris, where is this decision into the process, and who's the decider?
So the decider is the Secretary of the Air Force. The process now, they're still gathering comments on their draft environmental impact study. They expect to release a final study around January. Then there's a 30-day period, and so the final decision is expected to come in February. And if the base is chosen, we could see the F-35s as early as 2023.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Always happy to be here.
Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. He talked to us about the debate over stationing F-35 jets at Truex Field in Madison. Finally, today is Friday the 13th. There will be a full moon, so it's a perfect time for a spooky trip through an old mansion. People in the Superior area can do just that tonight, starting at 7:30 at the Fairlawn Mansion. Every Friday the 13th, Superior Public Museums hosts flashlight tours through the house. A few years back, WPR reporter Danielle Kading talked with former museum coordinator Stacey Buchanan about what to expect.
Fairlawn Mansion was built in the 1890s by Martin and Grace Pattison. He was a lumber baron and a mining baron in the area. He built Fairlawn after he became mayor of Superior. They lived in the house up until about 1920, and so it was used as a children's home from 1920 to 1962. And then after the children's home was closed, they decided to use it as a museum.
So there's been a lot of people coming and going over the years through that house.
A lot. With the children's home, we've had an estimated about 2,000 children come through the house.
And so every year you put on these flashlight tours.
Yeah, we do the flashlight tours Friday the 13th. So wherever a Friday the 13th falls, we do the flashlight tours. But what we do is we talk about the superstitions of life in the Victorian era, be it marriage or death, ghosts. There's a couple of different topics that they can pull from, but you do get to go through the house in the dark. So that's kind of the best part.
So what are some of the superstitions then that you talk about on the tour?
When I was doing flashlight tours, probably my favorite topic to talk about was death during that time. they didn't have funeral homes like we think of now. So most of the funerals would have taken place in the home itself. And so different superstitions they had with death, you had to cover up the mirrors so you wouldn't get possessed, how funerals would have taken place in a home such as Fairlawn. Some of the dress, like we think of, you know, you have to wear darker clothing, but actually they had very specific directions for whoever the family member was related to. They had issues with the clocks. They always stopped all of the clocks at the time of death. They did think that you could get possessed very easily or be taken with them to death.
Well, why did they think that at that time?
We don't know. Victorians is probably one of the most superstitious time era. Mm-hmm. They took a lot of what they learned from medieval times. So they were just obsessed with it. It was just the thing that they did.
And so were there any types of these funerals held at Fairlawn Mansion?
Martin Pattison did pass away in 1918, so he would have had a funeral at that time, and that would have taken place at Fairlawn.
And so you've worked in this house for 13 years.
Yeah.
And so any stories about that?
I do not personally have any stories. I have never come across anything. There are many stories out there, and we do touch on a couple of the biggest ones during the flashlight tours. We put it out there that we let you believe what you want to believe.
And so what are some of the things that people have said over the past they might have experienced?
I would have to say probably the biggest stories would be from staff members hearing children's laughter or playing near the pool in the basement. There was a story well out on the internet for many years that talks about two kids who would have drowned in the pool during the children's home. One of the other big stories that are out on the internet that's been out for years is that there's a servant who passed away suspiciously after she had left and married, and she came back to Fairlawn because it was the place that she was comfortable and felt welcome. And so she is spotted in many areas of the house, either helping tour guides when they get lost or anything like that.
That was Listen Back to WPR reporter Danielle Kading talking with former Superior Museum Coordinator Stacy Buchanan about flashlight tours at Superior's Fairlawn Mansion. Those are happening tonight starting at 7:30. Coming up, we'll keep the spookiness going. A Wisconsin scare chaser joins us to talk about what's really haunted in the state and how to do some supernatural-style tourism. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, should college athletes be paid? California took a big step in that direction this week. We'll break down the Fair Pay to Play Act and what might happen if it becomes law. First, our next guest has been around the world chasing all things bizarre, paranormal, and inexplicable. But he says back in his native Wisconsin, you can't throw a stone without hitting something or some place that has some haunted legend. And whether you're a believer or not, chasing these local legends can be a good start for some travel plans. Chad Lewis is a paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy Friday the 13th.
It's a special day for you, right?
It really is. I'm cursed. I was supposed to be in the studio with you.
You were.
But I was in northern Minnesota last night, and the floods came through and trapped me in that crazy land of Minnesota.
Well, yeah, you didn't even get to the supernatural. The natural kept you from getting down here today.
Yes, and sometimes that's even weirder.
Right. Now, a big thing for you, Chad, I know, is you are always looking for local legends of hauntings and other supernatural activity. And no matter how many you hear, there are always more out there, it sounds like.
There really are. I'm always learning new legends, folklore, and mysteries. And I figure if I do it another 20 years, there won't be one place in the Midwest that doesn't have a legend attached to it. But it just illustrates how popular and how much these legends just progress over the years.
And now you don't just collect stories. You like to experience the location firsthand, even if you don't experience the legend itself. How do you follow up on sort of a self-dares to check out supposedly haunted sites?
Well, I think in order to truly appreciate the legend, you have to see where it takes place, talk to the people where the legend has been brewing for years, and really just take a look at what may be causing it. And what I noticed at a lot of these alleged paranormal places is that a lot of them had dares attached to them, that you have to do something for the legend to come true. If you jump over the witch's grave, you'll be cursed and she'll chase you out of the cemetery, things of that nature. So a few years back, I started doing these dares for my own enjoyment, and then I started filming them just in case something were to happen.
Share one of them with us. Tell us about the story of, I think it's called Weary Road by Evansville.
Yeah, not too far from Madison, an old abandoned road, very neglected, highly spray painted by teenagers going out there. And the legend, there's a spirit of Old Man Weary who will chase you off of the road and throw a brick into your back window. But one of the dares is that if you park your car and shut it off on the bridge, you will not be able to start your car back up. And people have contacted me claiming that they had to be jumped, started out of there or towed out of there, that their brand new cars wouldn't function while they were there. And how these legends, the origin of them, oftentimes is very unknown, but yet they persist year after year after year.
All right, Chad, I got to ask, did you turn your car off on the bridge?
I did, and thankfully my car started back up. And cars play a huge role in these dares. There are many dares where if you park your car and put it in neutral, the spirits of those who lost their lives on a railroad track will push your car over the tracks to safety uphill, and you can see the prints on the back of your car. Or that if you park your car in Spooner, Wisconsin, out on Little Valley Road at night, a phantom hearse will appear behind you and chase you into town. So even if you don't want to get out of your car, if you're too afraid, you can still do these dares.
Talking to Chad Lewis, paranormal researcher here in Wisconsin. He's written books about hauntings in Wisconsin and the Midwest and beyond. Chad, for people who aren't paranormal researchers themselves, can we make this part of our kind of weekend travel plans?
I'm amazed at how many people contact me. Mother-daughter weekends, family trips, geocaching, bachelor parties, you name it. People go to these places. They take the back roads. They make an adventure of it. And I think that's the interesting part, is that most people who contact me about going to these places, they often remember something not even attached to the legend. Like when you're traveling and something mishap takes place, at the time, it's terrible. It really ruins your vacation. But years later, that's usually the story you're telling people about that trip. And it's the same thing with these legends, that if you go there, hopefully something happens. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but you'll have an adventure.
And Chad, you don't just do the dares themselves. You, I think, go out of your way to try to talk to locals wherever you are to see if they might have a story or a perspective on the local legend.
I try to dig up fact from fiction, try to find the origin. And what's interesting is I'll often talk to seniors in the area who remember the legend one way, and then you talk to teenagers and younger folks, and they have a completely different version of the same legend. It's just progressed and morphed, almost like the telephone game over the years.
So full moon tonight, Chad, Friday the 13th. What does Chad Lewis do on a night like this?
Yes, I'm going to be at one of my favorite places, a place near and dear to my heart, one of the first cases of hauntings I ever investigated. Many people believe that as Halloween gets closer, that veil between worlds gets thinner and thinner, allowing you to peek into this other dimension or world, whatever you believe. But remember, sometimes that means that dimension can peek back at you.
Now, talk about some rules for the non-supernatural locals. You know, some of these, I'm sure, are on private property. Give us some etiquette if we're wanting to maybe take on a dare or check out a site, but we want to be respectful of the currently living inhabitants.
Yes, I always promote places that are open to the public, and most graveyards are open until dark, and respect that. But also, I go to the places during the day, so you can feel them out and get a look and see if there are any holes in the ground that might twist your ankle or just any oddities. And then if you feel that things may happen more at dark, you can go back. Often I recommend not only bringing someone for safety if something were to happen, but if something paranormal happens, you have a witness there with you as well.
Chad, what's on your list of places in Wisconsin that you still want to visit for the first time or maybe revisit to give it another shot?
Yeah, I don't know if there's, well, maybe some of your listeners will tell me new spots that I haven't been, but One place I haven't been for about 5 or 6 years is outside of my hometown of Eau Claire, a river and an island called Mary Dean, where a young girl drowned in the 1800s. And the dare is that if you walk out into the water, the spirit of this woman will act like a siren and try to entice you under and pull you under, and you'll meet your watery grave. And I did it about 5 years ago, walking out into the river on my own and seeing if she would pull me under. But it was so much fun, I want to try it again.
Now, you've been at this a long time. What still keeps you excited about investigating and, in some cases, reinvestigating these local legends?
I think if you get into it thinking you're going to solve a case or explain what ghosts or monsters might be, you might burn out very quickly. Long ago, I saw it more as an adventure that, again, I'm hitting the back roads. I'm stopping at the roadside attractions that I didn't know were there. I'm staying at the mom and pop motels, getting a flavor of the legend and the people. And when I think more and more cities are starting to look the same with the same businesses, restaurants, and lodging, that these legends, they give somebody something unique. And that's what people, I think, are craving.
So you're approaching this more as kind of a supernatural explorer than like, I don't know, Scooby and Shaggy trying to figure out who's behind the mask.
Yeah, a lot of these places, it's very difficult. If I tell you that Elk Lake Dam in Wisconsin is not haunted and you go out there and have an experience, you're going to think it's haunted or vice versa. So I always leave it up to the reader, the listener, what be it, to go to these places. Don't take my word either way. Get out there and explore for yourself. And I think oftentimes you might find the scariest thing out there is often yourself.
Chad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Keep an eye out.
We will. That's Chad Lewis, paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer. We talked to him today about supernatural legends in Wisconsin and how to appreciate them, even if we're not trying to solve them. Coming up, we'll look at a plan that would allow college athletes to be paid, in this case for endorsements, and look at wider issues around compensation for student athletes at the college level. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to the head of Wisconsin's Public Service Commission about some of the big energy issues facing the state. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, lawmakers in California are on the verge of passing a bill that would pay college athletes for the use of their name, image, and likeness. Their state assembly passed the Fair Pay to Play Act on Monday by a vote of 72-0. The state Senate passed their version in the spring. Now the two chambers will have to resolve differences before it goes to Governor Gavin Newsom. In a tweet, Los Angeles Lakers star LeBron James called the move a game changer and added, quote, "College athletes can responsibly get paid for what they do and the billions they create." A day later, U.S. Senator and Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders tweeted, "College athletes are workers. Pay them." But some NCAA officials are opposed to paying student athletes because they say it would give California schools an unfair recruiting advantage. Matt Mitten is a professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School. Matt, good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rob.
Let's talk specifically about what they're doing. There have been a lot of different ideas out there about how to pay college athletes or how to allow them to get paid. This is one very specific plan, right?
Yeah. It's basically the objective would be that college athletes in California would be entitled to enter into endorsement deals with car dealerships, local supermarkets, whomever, and basically obtain, a licensing fee equal to the fair market value of what's known as their name, image, likeness rights, or publicity rights. And that's something that would be currently prohibited by the NCAA's amateurism rules.
But this wouldn't be a thing where they get a paycheck from the University of California, Berkeley, say. They don't. They wouldn't get a weekly or hourly wage for their job.
No, that's correct. It would be from third parties, like, I don't know, Vaughn Supermarket out there, or Jones Car Dealership, for example.
This would be in violation, in effect, of NCAA rules. So colleges in California, if this passed as planned, it would come into effect in a few years, they would have to decide whether to follow California state law or NCAA guidelines. This is all hypothetical at this point, but how could a school try to resolve that difference?
Well, the California universities would be in a very difficult position. As you point out, California law would prohibit them from doing anything that would prevent student athletes, like, let's say, the quarterback for the football team, or, you know, the point guard of the basketball team, from entering into this arrangement. The problem is that, by contract, as a member of the NCAA, they have agreed that only student athletes who are in compliance with the NCAA's eligibility rules can participate. So that's why the NCAA is saying California, you know, if this passes in California schools, I mean, you know, they're precluded from state law from prohibiting this from happening, you know, student athletes from entering into these agreements. If they allow them to participate in games, then the NCAA is saying, hey, we're going to enforce our eligibility rules, and these teams would not be eligible to participate in our championship competitions.
I want to give a little listen to Tim Tebow, former NFL quarterback. We heard LeBron James, his tweet in favor of this idea. Tim Tebow speaking on ESPN First Take this morning, not a fan of what California is working toward here. Here's a listen.
When I was at the University of Florida, I think my jersey was one of the top-selling jerseys around the world. It was like Kobe, LeBron, and then I was right behind them, and I didn't make a dollar from it. But nor did I want to, because I knew going into college what it was all about.
So not everybody on board with the idea. What are some of the objections, Matt, to college athletes getting paid, either directly or through endorsement deals?
Well, I think the first one is what Tim Tebow pointed out, is the NCAA has always tried to say, hey, playing college football or basketball, we're a different brand than the NFL or the NBA. Why? Because you know, college athletes are full-time students, and they are, quote, amateurs, as opposed to paid professionals. They don't get paid a salary by their member schools, and they can't exploit their name, image, likeness rights like professional athletes can do. That would be the first thing. The other thing is that the NCAA is going to say, look, there was a antitrust challenge to these rules, and the majority of a federal appellate court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, basically said, well, the NCAA can prohibit student athletes from receiving economic compensation over and above the full cost of attendance. That was found not to be an NCAA violation, and the majority said, you know, the NCAA can, you know, can preclude or prohibit student athletes from getting economic compensation untethered to education. And this California law would permit that, you know, by its terms, as I understand the law, it would let student athletes enter into these endorsement deals. And the NCAA would say, wait a minute, this doesn't violate antitrust law for us to prohibit it. And it's okay for us to tell NCAA colleges or universities, hey, if student athletes do this, you're in it, and you let them play, you can't participate in our championships. So there's a big potential problem there. The other one is whether this might be unconstitutional, this California law, because it's basically requiring California colleges and universities to do something that would violate their contractual obligations with the NCAA, and that's to only allow student athletes to participate who comply with these eligibility rules. There was a similar case where Nevada tried to impose additional requirements in NCAA rules enforcement proceedings that were over and above what NCAA rules required, and the Ninth Circuit struck that down on the theory that, well, state law cannot be used to directly regulate interstate commerce, which would be what the NCAA is engaged in as the national governing body for big-time college sports in the U.S.
Talking to Matt Mitten, professor of law, executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School, looking at pay for college athletes, a rule in the work, a law in the works, I should say, in California would allow college athletes to get endorsement money. That would be contrary, as we hear, to NCAA rules. What happens? Who knows? Matt, one of the arguments here from people advocating for athlete pay is that somebody is making a lot of money because of their efforts. Universities, the NCAA, apparel makers who can put names on jerseys, things like that. So why shouldn't the athletes get a cut since it's their effort that makes that possible? What do you say to that that side of the argument?
Well, there's something to be said for that, because it's no question that the reason so much money comes in, it's because the fans want to watch the athletes themselves. And, you know, that's a different question as to whether they should get paid or get, you know, to reap some part of their, you know, multi-billion dollar economic benefits. But I don't think it's appropriate for states to be making this determination, you know, on a state-by-state basis. The NCAA has a working group that's looking at this matter and deciding, you know, maybe we can modify these rules somewhat. And if they do, I was one of the ones that was asked to give my opinion on it. And I said, you know what, we should tie it to the educational benefits. So, for example, if student athletes are going to get a cut of the revenues, it should be tied towards remaining academically eligible, getting their degrees. So there, it's, you know, the receipt of these benefits based on, you know, one's name, image, and likeness rights, which are a product of one's academic achievement and fame, it ought to be tied to educational achievement. And it ought to be, you know, ideally done where the NCAA makes the modification or Congress enacts a law and says, here's what we think is fair and here's what we're going to require. Again, it's just problematic if individual states try to do this.
We're talking about whether college athletes should be paid one way or another. A bill in California would allow them to make endorsement deals, though they wouldn't be able to under NCAA rules. Matt Mitten is with us, professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think colleges and universities should pay their student athletes? Should athletes at the college level be allowed to be paid in endorsement form? Will paying athletes give some schools an unfair recruiting advantage? Do you have questions about the legality of all of this? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at a bill in the California State Legislature, the Fair Pay to Play Act, that would allow college athletes to make endorsement deals, contrary to the current rules under the NCAA. Matt Mitten is our guest, law professor and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this particular idea? Would you like to see something similar happen here in Wisconsin? Do you think the NCAA should change their rules, or Congress should? Or do you think things are right the way they are, that college athletes shouldn't be compensated beyond possibly scholarships and tuition? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Brad is with us in Milwaukee. Brad, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I think it's a double-edged sword. You know, I think some of these people who come in there with a full ride for a $200,000 scholarship No, you should not get paid. You've been paid. You've got a $200,000 scholarship. Now, for the people who play sports, who are paying everything out of pocket for themselves, yes, by all means, pay them, because it's not like they can go out there and get a part-time job, be a full-time student as well. Now, I know that not all scholarships are just handed out for sports, and, you know, there are intellectual scholarships as far as, you know, hey, you did great, whatnot. And, yes, they do get a free ride as well. But at the same time, if one student who's super smart but they come up with a cure for cancer, doesn't that become the intellectual property of the university, in which case they're not getting paid for the things that they have done? Why should someone get paid who's got a full ride scholarship at a $200,000 Ivy League school also get paid not exorbitant amounts of money, but a decent paycheck for a jersey with their name on it?
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. I'm not sure intellectual property might be a little outside of sports law, but I think that student could probably monetize that somehow. But what do you think, Matt, of what Brad had to say?
Well, you know, probably the ones whose publicity rights or name, image, likeness rights are likely to have the most fair market value are going to be football and basketball players who are getting, you know, the full ride, the full cost of attendance. The athletes in the other sports, you know, they probably work just as hard, but their sports don't generate a lot of revenue, so they might only have partial scholarships. And they're not as likely to have, you know, the economic value of their name, image, and likeness rights. So, for example, let's say someone who might be on the swim team or the lacrosse team, they're not as well known because those sports aren't televised as much. So even if they could exploit it, it's probably going to be worth, you know, very little, at least in comparison to the starting quarterback. You know, let's say at University of Wisconsin-Madison or the starting point guard at Marquette University. They're just going to be better known and have a higher value.
Thanks for calling in, Brad. We'll go now to Michael in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi. So I'm still undecided whether I think it's the best idea to introduce paid athletes into college sports. But what I do think that if you're going to pay the athletes on any level, there needs to be a cap across the league, because then I think it offers a substantial advantage to teams in larger markets. And I think recruiting should be based on the quality of your program and your coaching staff and the culture of the program, rather than, hey, we can pay you more at this school than X school over here.
Michael, thanks for the call. And Matt, is that something the NCAA would be thinking about, how it could affect competition if pay comes into the game?
Yeah, I think no question they have to do that, because, you know, there are certainly competitive equity concerns, because there are certain schools which have a larger alumni base, and you could tell, you know, their alumni, the business folks, they're going to want to say, okay, great, you know, we're going to offer, you know, a huge amount of money to you. Or schools that are in larger areas like Los Angeles, you know, in Wisconsin, you know, Milwaukee, the bigger cities. And that's almost certainly something that the NCAA task force is looking at. Is this, you know, if we're going to modify the rules to allow student athletes to, you know, market their name, image, and likeness rights, what are we going to do to make sure it doesn't create competitive imbalance concerns among, again, the NCAA's got 1,100 member schools. And that's what distinguishes sports from other forms of entertainment, is the competitive balance on the field, the uncertain outcome.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Matt Mitten from the Marquette University Law School, looking at the idea of compensating student athletes at the college level one way or another. A proposal in California, it's in the legislature, would allow them to receive endorsement money. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Tim with us in Viroqua. Tim, hello.
Hey, I guess my comments are relating to the potential inherent unfairness of this proposed idea in California, which is just ridiculous on the face of it, because, first of all, it's only talking about compensating those players who have some marketability. And what about all of the other student athletes at each school that you know, that only the star quarterback or the star running back or the, you know, the best basketball player on the team is banking his marketability when, you know, the entire soccer team and the entire swim team and the entire crew team and, you know, all the other student athletes at the school don't get anything.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. And that harks back to something you were saying, Matt. The marquee players might end up making tons of money and everybody else little or nothing.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And particularly the ones in the, you know, student athletes in most sports do not get a full scholarship or, you know, they don't have, you know, full cost of attendance scholarship. And so you have just equity concerns among, all right, you're going to have different student athletes at the same university being treated, you know, very differently because they will have a different marketability. So there's really a number of different facets to this. And the California law does not even consider that. It doesn't take into account competitive balance among schools, fairness among students, or even those on the same team. I think you run the potential if each individual athlete can, it's just whatever the market's going to pay for it. You know, how much attention is that going to take away from the focus on the game? It's like, well, am I more concerned about, hey, I got to have a great game so I maximize my individual endorsement value as opposed to doing what's in the best interest of the team? Now, they ought to be the same thing, but you know, there could be a whole host of really unintended consequences here, and it could adversely affect the quality of the games that fans are watching.
Time for one more caller. Dale is with us in Milwaukee. Dale, hello.
Hey, hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, what do you think, Dale?
You know, I think that these are all adults that we're talking about here. We're all talking about college adults. These are not, you know, underage students. These are people who have the ability to make a financial decision in most cases. And we keep talking about the, you know, the name and likenesses and whether or not that's being exploited or will be exploited by the player themselves or by the school, et cetera. But like we said, or you said earlier in the show, somebody is making money off the jerseys, the hats, et cetera. I mean, it just seems absolutely ridiculous that we wouldn't compensate the actual players of the game. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you so much.
Dale, thanks for the call. Matt, again, that's a commonly made argument on this issue.
Well, again, the question is, you know, how do you do it in a way that provides fairness among athletes and how do you maintain competitive balance? And that's why I think it's going to have to be a global nationwide solution. You can't have individual states like California or any others determining, okay, here's what we're going to allow to our in-state athlete. It's just not going to be workable over time. And the California law, even if enacted, is not going to go into effect for 3 years. I think almost certainly we're going to see some proposal from the NCAA, some sort of modification, or Congress gets involved. It's just not workable when you have a patchwork of different states doing this.
And briefly, Matt, I've seen the argument that this California law, with that three-year delay, might be intended as a kick in the pants for some kind of national solution. Do you think that sets a timer for the NCAA and or Congress to tackle the issue?
Oh, I think no doubt. I mean, the NCAA is already, its task force is going to say, here's what our recommendations are, and there's plenty of time for the NCAA legislative process to work to make any changes. If Congress doesn't like what the NCAA decides to do. So, yeah, I think it's really designed to be kind of a stimulus to, you know, to get some movement on the issue.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, my pleasure.
That's Matt Mitten, professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University's Law School. We talked to him about a bill in California that would let college athletes there sign endorsement deals that would bring it into conflict with the NCAA. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the Trump administration is overturning a water protection rule put into place by President Obama. We'll find out what changes and what it could mean here in Wisconsin. And should we share images of our children online? Our guest says, think twice about what it means for our kids. That and more Monday on Central Time.